Good morning. I think you're retired by all the introductions. So now you, some of you have another misfortune to listen to what you already know. And I apologize otherwise because I think I have to give some introduction to tell new things. And I'm afraid that it will be, well, maybe perhaps too elementary to some and maybe not entirely known to others. So just bear with me if you can. So I'll be talking about one-dimensional many-body physics, and I'll be interested in discussing the dynamic correlation functions for interacting bosons or fermions in 1D. I'll speak mostly about fermions. And I'm sorry for introducing the question I actually want to pose. I have to recall what's done usually in higher dimensions. And in higher dimensions, the standard picture of interacting not exotic, but just plain vanilla fermions is Landau fermi liquid. And the idea is that if you start with Fermi gas and gradually turn on interaction, then basically the eigenstates of free fermions evolve, as long as we are interested in low energy excitations, evolve into quasi-particles, also with Fermi statistics, which in the limit of low energy measured from the Fermi level are free. And then you can introduce or actually derive residual interactions with them, within them, and they, these interactions turn out to be weak. It manifests itself in a very basic quantity. You can look at a spectral function of a fermion, which is minus imaginary part of retarded Green function for a fermion. It has the conventional pole structure where the imaginary part of the pole, which is just the imaginary part of self-energy taken at the mass shell, is finite but small. So it's proportional to the interaction strength gas parameter R squared. So usually it's just E squared over H bar VF times energy epsilon squared divided by Fermi energy. And epsilon is measured from the Fermi level. So that's, yeah, and I put twiddle here because there's also a real part of self-energy that renormalizes the bare spectrum of fermions. So this is, I mean, basic but yet very robust statement because the epsilon squared comes simply from the phase space argument, and even if interaction is not weak, RS is order of one, that remains valid. So basically, the spectral function is a sharp function. It's Lorentzian as a function of energy at given k. So if I fix k and look at at a as a function of epsilon, it's Lorentzian with widths that scale as 1 over tau epsilon. That's the conventional 3D case. In 2D case, there is some small correction. I mean, it's not epsilon squared, but epsilon squared times some logarithm. But basically, the basic thing that it gets sharp, so the quasi-particles are well-defined near the Fermi level. So that's the main thing about Landau Fermi liquid for me here now. Now, if you go to 1D and try to repeat the same calculation, turns out that the imaginary part of self-energy, and I will have to write now self-energy is a function of energy and momentum, is not that nice as here. It does not have finite value at the mass shell. And moreover, its structure is not analytical. It has a theta function dependence on energy measured from the mass shell. So actually that's bad, because if we look at spectral function just perturbatively expand in m sigma, like here, so it's epsilon minus psi minus, minus sigma expand in m sigma, and then AK epsilon in perturbation theory will acquire a term V squared, and that's what LR stands for, times theta of epsilon minus psi k divided by epsilon minus psi k. Now, for one-dimensional fermions, say this parabolic dispersion relation, it's convenient, if you're talking about energies close to the Fermi level, it's convenient to introduce interactions between lefts and rights, and interaction within rights and within lefts. So basically, I wanted to emphasize that this kind of malicious part of the interaction comes from the interaction between lefts and rights. Right. Yes. So So as to the divergence, it happens for spinless and spinful. I mean, this unpleasant thing is there. Now, if you go to higher orders, segregation is different for spinless and spinful. I'll be talking mostly about spinless. At the very end, I hope I'll tell a little bit about spinful.
So for this is for spinless, right?
Yeah, that's for spinless, yeah. So basically, so one simple thing is that for spinless, if you want to express this interaction in terms of the Fourier components of bare potential, for spinless, it's V of 0 minus V of 2kF. For spinful, it's V of 0 minus 2 times V of 2kF. That's Hartree and Fock terms. The Fock term is coefficient 2. So if I remember, that's at that level, it's the only difference. So in particular, if you have point-like interaction, then for spinless particles, there is no interaction because they cannot be at the point. But for spinful, it's still not trivial, because even for delta function, you can have two particles with opposite spins in some at one point. So if you go to higher orders, actually it doesn't get cured. So the singularity remains, and it's well known. And so the weapon of choice how to deal with this problem is the concept of Luttinger liquid. So this concept of Luttinger liquid is based on a test case, which is a solvable Tamanaga-Luttinger model. So for Tamanaga-Luttinger model, what is done, that you just forget about the spectrum and look at problem with linear spectrum. For left and right movers, velocity is independent on momentum. Then it turns out, and again I'm skipping about a decade of development between 1950 and 1973-74, people figured out how to solve exactly the problem with linear spectrum and interactions between the fermions. So that's all known. But what's more important that this linear model is a good is perceived to be a good approximation for the real thing if you're interested in low energies, and that becomes and the meaning of this simplification becomes most clear in the bosonization technique. That translates essentially the quantum many-body problem into a problem of dynamics of of some quantum fluid, and now I'll follow essentially a cartoonish version of Duncan Haldane's paper of '83. So the idea that If you're interested in excitations with long wavelengths, so small wave vectors, you may try to encode them in the following way. So take the momentum space, which is in 1D, is just a line. In the equilibrium, all states between minus kf and kf are occupied. We're talking about spinless fermions, and kf is the Fermi wave vector. And then a smooth perturbation would be to tell that you put, say, more right movers, so you shift the right Fermi point to some k right as a function of x. And you maybe take out or put more locally left movers. So you shift the left Fermi point to some k left of x. So once again, k right is not necessarily equals minus k left. It may be not equal or equal, so it doesn't matter. And if these two things are equal, then simply it means that we boost the system at some special point, so there is non-zero momentum, but there is no non-zero extra density. And if these two guys are not equal to each other, then we also introduce some local density deviating from the nominal. So having these two fields, k left of x and k right of x, I can introduce two, I would say, displacement fields by the relation k right minus kf. So k right minus the nominal value is some divergence of phi right, and k left plus kf is divergence of some field phi left. And now you may recall that the energy measured from the Fermi level can be written for right and left movers for a parabolic spectrum, so for curved spectrum, in the form of plus or minus, depending on rightness or leftness, Vf delta k, so it's k measured from appropriate Fermi point, plus delta k squared over 2m. And then we can write the kinetic energy density as integral dk xi k between k left of x, sorry, and k right of x. So it's a quadratic expression. You plug it in here, integrate, get cubic in k left k right expression for the density of kinetic energy, which then can be expressed in terms of the divergences of the fields far left, far right. So it produces a nice quadratic term. And not so nice cubic term. I hope I didn't. Yeah, I think it's 6. So that's the kinetic energy, and basically that's all bad that happens. The interaction, which the usual villain in the many-body problem, actually becomes our friend, because in terms of these displacement fields, it's a quadratic expression. So interaction is proportional to the interaction constant times the density squared. So basically, it will be the divergence of phi right minus divergence of phi left squared. So basically, that's the Hamiltonian.
Not quite higher than quadratic, even if it's a non-interactive.
Right, exactly. Yes. So that's what I'm trying to convey. And that's not me. I mean, that is a known problem, that the simulation is nice, fantastic, dealing with interactions. But you have to pay. Here's the price. Okay? Now, in many cases, it's nothing. It doesn't count as a complication, as I'll tell you in a second. In some cases, it is a complication, and that what the talk would be about. So maybe again to finish this this standard introductory part. So this is a Hamiltonian, but you want to calculate some observables. So and that leads to some dynamic correlation function. So for example, Green function, which is psi of xt. Psi dagger of 0, 0. So one needs to learn how to express psi in terms of phi. And again, it's it was all done. Yeah, so basically, what I do now is a review of Duncan Haldane in 83. So it's convenient to introduce, instead of the fields of left and right movers for now, the field that corresponds to the density. So phi of x, which is the difference between phi right minus phi left, times 1/2. And field theta of x, which is corresponds to momentum. So gradient phi has meaning of density. Density measured from the nominal equilibrium density, and gradient theta has meaning of momentum density. So these are natural objects to do the second quantization. You can quantize by commutation relation. I don't remember, it's plus or minus pi, I pi delta of x minus y, where this is taken at x and this is at y. Again, signs I'm not sure about. Gradient theta is momentum density. So theta of x is an operator of an infinitesimal shift. And you can imagine that you have a fluid with fixed density, say n naught. Okay, and if you apply operator e to I theta to the ground state, then what it does, it takes all the liquid to the left of point x and shifts it by some nominal unit value. So that what happens then is like on a crowded highway. So you shift all the particles, but you don't shift these particles, right? So here you have a pile up. And if you tune properly the constant here, this pile up contains just one extra particle. So this is a good candidate for operator psi dagger. Except it doesn't obey the commutation relations because thetas commute with each other, so that would not be a Fermion. And again, I'm vulgarizing it terribly, but basically you can repair it by summing, by multiplying it by a sum e to plus minus ikfx times e to plus minus I phi of x. So theta and phi don't commute, and that produces the right commutation for psi dagger. And in addition, we do appreciate the fact that basically we're talking about waves which have the basic frequency plus minus kf, or basic pitch k plus minus kf, and the excitation of density are just slightly modifying the periodicity of these waves. So that's this plus minus I kfx is the corresponds to the fermions moving to the right and to the left. So now, if you just dispense with this term, and formally it means taking 1 over m to 0. Okay, so linear spectrum is infinite mass. It's not zero mess. So people in graphene like to say that it's Dirac. It's no. So linear spectrum is actually infinite mess. And in this limit, there is no this term. And life is easy, right? Because if you throw away this term, then calculating of a correlation function with the use of Bayesian relation formulas is just calculating Gaussian average, right? Because we have linear in phi exponent and phi in theta exponent, and we have to average it with a Hamiltonian, which has two beautiful quadratic parts. So that's, well, that's all what Bayesianization does for you, and that's a lot. So once again, for technical reasons, if I switch to the variables phi and theta, I can write Hamiltonian density, rather, these two parts together. These two parts without the cubic term, in the following way. Okay. So it's v over 2 pi k dx theta squared plus 1 over k dx phi squared. So v now is the velocity which one obtains by diagonalizing this Hamiltonian. So in general physics, this velocity is called plasma velocity. So basically, it's a collective excitation velocity. The rigidity is provided by the Fermi rigidity and also by interactions. So in principle, if you have very strongly repulsive fermions, you can forget about their the Fermi repulsion or Fermi rigidity, and just account for the interaction. And vice versa, for free fermions, you still have finite velocity, just equals to Fermi velocity, and capital V is out. So V, again, for this very simplistic way of introducing Bayesianization, V is Vf squared plus Vf times V. And I hope that I didn't make a mistake in coefficients. And K is the ratio of Fermi velocity to the collective velocity. So for repulsion, K is less than 1. Now, once again, for technical reasons, it's convenient for me to introduce yet another set of variables, phi tweedle, which is phi over square root k, and theta tweedle, which is theta times square root k. They conjugate with the same commutation relation, but they hide this constant k. So in this form, actually, if spectrum is linear, we manage to cast the Hamiltonian with interactions into form that is identical up to the definition of constant to the free fermion Hamiltonian, right? Because the only thing that happened from here to here is that Vf is changed to V. So in a way, it shows that for linear spectrum, there is no difference. Fermions, bosons, in principle, go back to fermions and get some free fermion Hamiltonian. So now, what about observables? So that will be perhaps the last thing from the standard Leitinger liquid. So as we discussed, the Green function is just average over the linear exponents with quadratic Hamiltonian here.
So when do we get these cosine terms? I guess they backscatter, right, from the left to the right.
Right. So, okay. So without spins and without lattice, they will not appear. Without spin and without lattice, you cannot distinguish between the process in which two particles backscatter and go through. Okay, they are indistinguishable ferments. So therefore, a reminiscence of the existence of two processes is that actually, if you want, as Misha asked, if you ask what is capital V, it turns out to be in bare terms as V of 0 minus V of 2kF. If there are spins, situation changes because then going through or backscattering, you can label states by spin and you can distinguish. And then there is a cosine term. What is important is that although there is cosine term, if it's SU2, if there is no magnetic field, at least, and you go to lowest energies, the cosine term actually vanishes. I mean, in RG sense, meaning that if you start with wideband and end with narrow, so. Again, in my story, spin would matter, but it's somewhat involved even without spin, so I'll push spin things maybe to the very end. And also, I don't know, I know some things about spin, but not everything that I would like to. Yeah, so basically, to end up this thing, so if you calculate Green function, then one may look at two kinds of quantities. One is one kind is local quantity, and the most spectacular representative is local density of states. So as a function of energy, okay, and that's basically minus 1 over pi, imaginary part of the Green function, taken at x equals 0. So x, but not k, right, at x equals 0. And if one does the calculations that I just mentioned, averaging the exponent, linear exponents with quadratic action, you'll get the results that about 18 years ago kind of captured imagination. You'll get a power law. And for free fermions k equals 1, because v equals vf, so it will be just constant as it should. But for, say, repulsive fermions k is less than 1, as well for attractive k is larger than 1, but anyway, so this whole thing is positive, and the density of states is suppressed at zero energy. Now, another kind of quantities is momentum resolved kind of quantities. Okay, so momentum resolved the simplest example is again just the Green function, or actually the spectral function AFK epsilon and once again, the same procedure, if you perform it, yields the following result. So 1 over epsilon minus vk, that's what we would expect for free fermions. But in addition, there is a factor with some exponent. Which makes the behavior of A at the mass shell non-analytical, has a cut. So here's a graph, figure of A as a function of epsilon fixed k. So it's a power law above the mass shell. There's also some, I would say, ghost non-zero the region where A is not zero at epsilon less than minus vk. And that what would replace a delta function for free fermions, right? So for free fermions, A of epsilon is just delta function of epsilon minus vk. Okay. Now, as if you remember, we had a correction, a second order correction in terms of the interaction we left right, and it was 1 over epsilon minus vk. Okay, in higher orders it gets dressed, as you see. So divergence remains, but it's some parallel. Now, so how to understand this parallel on simple language? Here it is. So we have the branch of right movers and branch of left movers. And spectral function is nothing but the probability of tunneling at given momentum and energy. So you can try to tunnel a particle off mass shell. Well, if you try to put a particle with epsilon equals vk, then it's no-brainer. It just goes there. But you can try to put a particle into the system at energy, say, larger than, higher than the mass shell. Then in perturbative language, you can do the following thing. You can exchange this particle onto excitation on the right branch and a pair, particle, whole pair on the left branch. And this way you will absorb the extra energy. Okay, and the momentum is kind of compensated because you create a particle that moves in opposite direction. So basically you take the proper momentum and distribute it between the particles that moves to the right and a pair that moves to the left. So it tells you that actually one can play this game above the mass shell. It's impossible to play it below the mass shell for linear spectrum. And that opens basically some regions above the mass shell where the spectral function is not zero. And basically this line is a constant k cut of this figure. So if I take k larger than kf in this particular case, this point corresponds to divergence, and the higher points correspond to tunneling a particle that nominally has off-shell energy, but you can kind of spread its energy between the excitations in the system. So finally, the last object that I wanted to introduce is the simplest one. It's the structure factor. Okay, so structure factor is a free component of the density-density correlation function, and it appears naturally in absorption of light, for example, by fermions, right? So any field that couples to the density, if I want to derive formula for linear absorption, I'll express it in terms of structure factor. So S of k omega is Fourier component. Of density-density correlation function, and that doesn't require any calculation even, because for linear spectrum, the only velocity present in the system is velocity of this excitation, V. So this thing ought to be proportional to delta function, and it's Q times delta omega minus Vk. All right, so that's all what is well known for the conventional Schrödinger liquid, and as Herr Bast, so what happens if one takes into account cubic term?
So Qk is the same thing?
Pardon?
Qk is the same?
Yes, thanks. Yeah, I sort of reserved k for fermions and q for densities. But. Right, so power counting tells that these terms, in terms of irrelevance, they are irrelevant. Now, what does it mean physically? If I calculate corrections to the local density of states, to this very formula, due to cubic terms in the Hamiltonian, these corrections will be small. So it's epsilon to some power with exponent less diverging than this one. Okay, so I don't remember precisely the number, but anyway, so the leading asymptote for small epsilons is this term, and the corrections due to cubic term are small. It's additive small correction. Okay, so that is the meaning of the correct limit of low energies, right? So if I look at energies which are close to the Fermi level, epsilon is small compared to epsilon f, then these terms contribute some small additive correction of higher order to the local density of states. But if we look at the dynamic quantities, it's different. And first of all, we must, okay, so who cares? Okay, we have this wonderful quantity. Why should we go further? So there is a number of effects, actually, that are sensitive to momentum-resolved properties of a one-dimensional liquid. And one thing that we... One nasty thing that we have done to the original problem is that we made spectrum particle hole symmetric, right? So it's linear function. So there is no basically difference between particles and holes. They move at the same velocity. So we throw away right from the very beginning a set of phenomena that relies on the asymmetry. For example, thermal power, and for example, things like drag effect. This small momentum transfer. If you imagine having two wires, quantum wires, and you send current in one and want to measure voltage induced on another one, intuitively it seems clear, right? Because particles move, there are more right movers, they can scatter, transfer momentum to these guys, so why don't we build up voltage? So, for linear spectrum, momentum is transferred. If you have a hot particle in the lower wire, it may relax and excite a hot particle in upper wire. But the velocity of this guy is the same as was here, so nothing happens. There is no secondary voltage, and that's basically because there is particle symmetry, and thermal power as well as drag effect does need this asymmetry. I mean, going further, so linear spectrum proclaims that there is divergence of the spectral function at some line. But the original spectrum was parabolic, okay? So what we are saying is that, okay, let's forget about parabola and replace it by line here. And divergence will be here, right? But then there are experiments. And Amir Akobi, who was here last week and didn't talk about yet another set of quite cute experiments, he's able to measure tunneling between two parallel wires, resolving energy and momentum. So basically, he is able to measure, roughly speaking, requires some deconvolution, this subject, FK epsilon. And if you look at his figures, they look more like this than like this, and sure enough, I mean, this is just our imagination. Okay, this part has to be there because the energy depends on momentum, not in linear fashion. So then there is some, basically what we are doing is some kind of hypocrisy, because we are saying that okay, there is a divergence in line at line where not, actually nothing should happen. So the very generic question appears actually. Is there a real divergency in this object if you take into account curvature of spectrum? And if it's there, then where is it? This line or some other line? Now, that basically tells me what is the limit in which Luckinger liquid is the right description for the resolved in energy and momentum quantities. So let's look at some momentum k away from kf. And the difference between the linear extrapolation and the true, quote unquote, spectrum, at least true for non-interacting particles, this difference in energies is a order of k minus kf squared over 2m. Now, Lycos-Drake description is valid at low energies, meaning that we have to take limit k minus kf over kf to zero. That's for sure. But we still have another variable, which is epsilon. And I can look at the ratio epsilon over vk divided by this distance, divided by another characteristic energy, k minus kf squared over 2m. So this quantity doesn't appear in linearized spectrum, but it is there in the original spectrum. So taking this limit, I may envision two situations. One is that I keep this guy fixed, and then look at the result as a function of this ratio. Okay, that would be studying a near vicinity of the mass shell. Another way is to just take this limit without caring about this quantity, so at fixed epsilon minus vk, at fixed epsilon minus vk. And if I fix epsilon minus vk instead and take this limit, this will go to infinity. So basically, Lycos-Drake liquid, as far as we're talking about momentum resolve properties, tells me what happens to the spectral function somewhere here. But it doesn't tell me about the close vicinity of the mass shell. And one last question was actually what happens around the vicinity of the mesh shell, and actually where is the mesh shell? So that is the place where cubic terms that were thrown out may become important, and it becomes even more transparent for this quantity, for the spectral density, for the structure factor, which for linear spectrum is delta function. And it's clear that it's an artifact of linear spectrum. S is a function of frequency at fixed Q. It's delta function, and somehow cubic terms must broaden it, because cubic terms are responsible for nonlinearity of spectrum. So basically, dealing with cubic terms as a perturbation to linear spectrum is bad. And I think that Pereira perhaps was giving talk a few weeks ago, and perhaps he was telling about that. But if you try to calculate, okay, so S is the density-density correlation function, which in bosonic terms is just correlation dx phi dx phi. And if you try to calculate correction due to cubic terms, it's calculating of a diagram where a boson counts its momentum k, splits on 2 with momenta q and k minus q, and then combined again into k. And for linear spectrum, you see immediately that you get zero denominator, because for linear spectrum, energies, sum of energies is exactly this energy. So that's why perturbation theory is badly divergent. And how to deal with it, I don't know. And apparently, not only me. So that's why we tried something else. So once again, I mean, it's a generic problem, because for linear spectrum, there is a huge, immense degeneracy between the excitations. I mean, you can take a particle at linear spectrum with some energy, or you can take, you can split it on another particle and particle excitation, and it will have the same energy, and you can do it again and again. So there are lots of different excitations that have the same energy. And that is the degeneracy that gets removed by the cubic term And as usual in quantum mechanics, perturbation theory in the general spectrum is tricky. So after this exposition, what I'll do is the following. I'll tell the idea that perhaps also most of you know, and then tell how to use the idea to come up with a description that is almost as good as Ratzinger liquid, but accounts for the curvature. So the idea that we came across is that we may go to Fermionic language and to start with treat the curvature exactly, but interaction perturbatively. So it's a plain vanilla perturbation theory in the interaction. And once again, the simplest object to look at is the structure factor. So instead of writing formulas, you can imagine that you have Fermi gas, and then you shine a photon, and you create an excitation, a hole and particle, and you fix by photon momentum the transferred momentum, and by photon energy you fix the energy of the particle excitation, and then by Fermi golden rule you can just write S of q omega is sum over momenta, the Fermi function at the initial momentum, times one minus n k plus q at above the Fermi level, should be above the Fermi level, and delta function psi k plus omega minus psi k plus q. So again, for parabolic spectrum, it's just this thing is linear in k. These guys are just theta functions. So you end up with integral between kf minus q and kf, delta of omega minus kq over m minus q squared over 2m. So integral of delta function is theta function. So this is the result. You can look it up in Feta and Valechka text. The width of the thing is q squared over m. The height is 1 over q, m over q. So that's the result for free fermions. Now, good news and bad news. So good news is that it again reaffirms the idea of relevance of cubic terms, or 1 over m terms, because this is narrow, it's q squared. Now if you calculate the area, so if you calculate integral d omega between these two points, omega minus, omega plus, s of q omega, you'll get q. Mass cancels out. And that's exactly what this limit tells you. So simple things work. That's all for good news. And the bad news is that the width is not perturbative in 1 over mass, because actually even for negative mass you'll get a finite width, 1 over absolute value m. So that actually explains why perturbation theory in curvature is bad. And it's far from being Lorentzian, so there is little hope that finite order perturbation theory and cubic terms would help. But having this picture actually allows to see the physics of what interaction does really in 1.5 steps. So half step is already done, so we calculated the result for no interaction. So now what happens in the first order.
So your zero approximation was mass equal infinity, right?
Zero approximation in bosonic language. Okay, and
I. Width is small, so why is it small?
Yes, thanks. So width is small, but it's proportional to 1 over the absolute value of mass, right? So if I try to get this result by perturbation theory from here, okay, it cannot be first order because average of what powers of phi is 0. Okay, so it can be first order.
In this sense, it's...
Okay, so, and second order, it's 1 over m squared, but it's times infinity. So, in Bayesianization, the first term was 0, second term was infinity. And the true answer is that this width is 1 over absolute value m. So, it...
In sense of power.
In sense of power, yeah. Well, in sense of analytical properties, if you wish, right?
So, yeah.
Okay, so that's... Right, so so if I take into account interaction, it's remarkably simple. So in the lowest order, because basically, on a more formal language, what was calculated there is polarization operator, a loop. You can view this line as whole line, and this line is a particle line. Erase it already. Whole line, particle line. And now, if I want to go to the first order, there are two ways to include interaction. One is corresponding to what is called vertex correction. Another one is like in RPA series, the first term. Now, the factor is imaginary part of this thing. And now we need imaginary part of this sum. So if I call this object chi naught, susceptibility for free fermions, then imaginary part of the correction, delta S, is a product of imaginary part of chi naught times real part of chi naught times interaction. And I'll skip the details, but basically I can replace interaction by zero v-vector interaction. And up to, well, perhaps sign is wrong, but these two guys go with different signs, since I remember. This is similar thing. But momentum is conserved, so this is VQ. So once again, I need to calculate, let's consider this guy, a product of loop times interaction, and take imaginary part. So imaginary part of the product is product of imaginary part times real part plus real times imaginary, right? Now, imaginary part of this thing was just calculated, and here is a figure. Okay, so imaginary part of chi naught has a step. It has a step, and therefore, due to Cramer's chronic, a real part must have a logarithm. Right? So there's causality corresponding to analytical properties of certain analytical properties of the susceptibility as a function of omega. And if there is, so as a whole, it must be an analytical function. And if you know the imaginary part being a step function, then we know real part and its logarithm. So basically, it tells me that the correction to the structure factor is proportional to interaction. The constant here will be m over q, if I remember right, times theta. And if I consider it in the vicinity of this point, of the left point, it's theta of omega minus, that comes from imaginary part times logarithm omega minus, the sum cutoff that is, I'll just replace by q squared over m. So what we are getting is log divergence of the first order correction to the structure factor. And upon inspection, the origin of this divergence becomes very clear and identical to another part of a text on many body physics. It's Fermi singularity. So basically, what happens can be understood in the following way. You have a Fermi C, and this point omega minus corresponds to absorption of such a photon whose energy is barely enough to create a particle above the Fermi level. So at the end of the absorption process, there is a hole in the Fermi C and a particle just above the Fermi level. And they interact. So if you take into account that the spectrum is not linear, the velocity of the hole is different from the velocity of particles, of the Fermi particles, Vf minus Q over M. So they move with different velocity. And if you move yourself to a reference frame where this hole is just as static, then it becomes essentially identical to the conventional formulation of Fermi singularity. So there is a particle that interacts with the hole and moves with some velocity with respect to the hole. And this is the first logarithm that was discovered by Mehen in 60. I was preparing to the talk in 67. and then, again, this story is very well developed, but we cannot take it all. What we can do is to try to sum up the leading log. And for summing the leading log, there are various devices. I'll just give the answer, but then show a device that, okay, so now actually I'm running out of time. So
you're not running out of time, it's fine.
Another 20 minutes or so. I'm getting to the line at which it starts to be new. And
you don't have another speaker, so you can keep going.
But you can vote with your feet. I'll tell the first of all the answer for the summing of leading logs. So leading logs means that I go to higher orders and collect powers, interaction to power n times logarithm to power n, and then show a device how to do it, which will tell me how to do it actually better than just summing the logs. So the result of summation is for the vicinity of a threshold, of the threshold omega minus. Yep.
Diagrammically, what is summing?
Okay, diagrammically, it's called so-called parquet diagrams.
In the left one, from the left one. Yeah.
From the.
Oh, which originate from the left one. You know, you have two diagrams here.
Oh, right. So you can generate from this diagram. You can generate some series. And again, there is a very good description that I found recently. There is a text by Gagolin. Narcissan and Svelik, and there is appendix on parquet diagram where it's finally written for mortals. I mean, we really can follow how it happens. But I mean, since it was back, I don't know, Sudakov, also early 60s, Termotiasan Sudakov, but then people invented RG, and basically it all became much simpler. But indeed, you can generate some diagram starting from this one. The series will produce a parallel like this with mu s. And again, because it's leading log, mu s that we can find this way will be linear in the interaction. It's 1 over pi v0 minus vq divided by q over m. So now, how to find this without diagrammatic exercises. Basically, for that also, there is a trick that was invented in 69 by Schott and Schott, and that's yet another use of Bazinization. So the origin of singularities, as we discussed here, comes from the fact that you have a particle just above the Fermi level, and if you go to higher orders, virtually can create more pairs which are soft with small energies, and summation of this soft over the soft pairs actually produces higher order log terms. So each term where you have additional pair with energy close to the Fermi level gives you additional power of log together with additional power of the interaction. Because what's important is the part of spectrum close to the Fermi level. We may try to abbreviate our problem and keep a part of spectrum where the whole lives and the part of spectrum where these pairs live and throw out the rest. Just throw out, not renormalization, just throw out and that's it. So this way you'll get, instead of the original spectrum, just two pieces of it. The piece near the Fermi level. And I will linearize the spectrum. And the piece around point kf minus q, where the hole may be placed, and I also will linearize this part of spectrum. So the fermion annihilation operator will be our right moving operator for k minus kf close to the Fermi surface. So this scale is q. Q is given by the external light. Okay, so this is q, external momentum. And this part of the band is narrow in this sense. And it's some other operator, quote unquote other operator, d, at momentum k plus q. For the place where hole will be living upon absorption of a photon. So the Hamiltonian includes the free particles near the Fermi surface. Right words. Plus it contains the energy of this hole, omega minus plus Vd k, dk dagger dk, plus interaction. And I know what interaction is. It is here. And the difference again comes because of the difference between the Hartree and Fock terms. So basically, I can exchange these two particles. And that subtracts from V of zero this interaction V of q. The same way as these two diagrams come together. So it's density of right movers times density of the d particle. Alright, so now we just perpetrated the crime that people did earlier for Lightning Zurich, right? We linearized spectrum. But we'll benefit from this crime. Having linear spectrum, I can do Bazinization. So I will make this part look as free bosons. Then this part, interaction, will look like interaction of additional particle with some bosonic field. Okay, so upon bosonization, this Hamiltonian becomes Vf over 2 pi integral dx, and write it in real space, dx phi right squared, this is this term, plus some interaction ur, integral dx dx phi r times d dagger of x d of x. This is this term. And ur is v0 minus vq over 2 pi. And finally, this term is etal dx d dagger of x omega minus plus the velocity of the hole vd times I d dx, perhaps minus d. So that is the Hamiltonian. And once again, before the photon is absorbed, the d state is empty. There is no this part. And we have just free field of right movers. Then light shines. We create a particle at some point x. Here's a Hamiltonian. And this particle interacts with the field of right movers. So this Hamiltonian can be solved, and that's basically what Schott and Schott did around 69 for basically treating the conventional Fermi singularity problem. They look at three-dimensional problem, but if you look on the S-wave scattering, you can do the similar trick. So how to do it technically? Well, it's quadratic, so you just complete the square, right? You can shift the field phi r so that interaction is gone at the expense of having grad phi r minus d dagger d. But d dagger d equals 0 or 1, so it's just before the absorption is 0, after absorption is 1. So you suddenly shift your oscillators. And technically, this transformation that gets rid of the interaction is produced by a unitary transformation. Which I can write in the following way. So delta plus, which technically is just this shift, which I need to take out this term or complete the square. This delta plus equals, because of the procedure that I'm suggesting to do, should be equal to u r of q over vf minus vd. But it has very simple meaning. So delta plus actually is phase shift. In the Fermionic language, we have a scatterer, the d particle. And the scatter fermion is momentum k on this d particle. So it's right mover. And by passing over the scattering potential, it acquires some phase. Delta plus is exactly this phase shift. So it's a very simple quantum mechanical, single particle quantum mechanical object. All right, so that's how can we simplify the Hamiltonian. But now, how do we calculate the structure factor?
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, sure.
So, it's evident, but I know it's bigger, so I mean, it's... So people looked at Fermi singularities for when you have mobile holes, right? So
yeah. Yeah.
So you could do the same thing there.
Yes. Yeah. Right. So you're lucky to see by the classic in the field. So the point is that you're absolutely right. That actually, I mean, I looked through Mahan's paper. It's amazing that he understood that. But basically, honestly speaking, there is no Fermi singularity in 3D metals. And the reason for that is that, okay, you create a hole. You shine X-ray, you create a hole, deep hole in the particle. But this deep hole is short-lived, so to speak, because other electrons can fill it. And singularity is cut off by the inverse time of the inverse lifetime of the hole.
Is it also like a nucleus that can be controlled by attack of the hole is mobile,
right? Right. So the question is whether in 1D the same thing happens. So the point is that it was made by a number of people. Is that actually in 1D, due to kinematics, it doesn't happen. And the reason is that you cannot relax, at least theoretically, in this model, you cannot relax a hole in 1D because the hole velocity is less than Fermi velocity. Right? So if you try to scatter a hole and translate it to some other place, you will violate energy conservation, because if it gives momentum to Fermi particle, velocity is higher, and you need higher energy in order to.
Cherenkov.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. So it's there is absence of Cherenkov radiation for holes, but not for particles. And right. Yeah. And this is so when you violate linearity, immediately there is a difference between particles and holes. Holes don't relax and particles do. And actually, this is observed, that indeed particles do relax and holes apparently not.
Let me ask one simpler question. Suppose you have, I'm asking, I guess, here, a question about formation, right? Suppose you have two belts, right? Hole, and belts, and conduction, right?
Yeah.
And then usually, like my concept, the whole band completely flat. So
yeah.
Now you seem to be trying to.
So you want to do this, right?
But now you want some finite curvature. So
yeah.
So that thing can move and hold can move. So
right.
You can. I imagine you can do this type of treatment with stabilization treatment here and there.
Yeah.
And then compare results with what people who calculated for Fermi singularity of the recoil.
Yes. Right. So.
The results agree.
Yes, so the point is that in 1D there is no recoil. That's what I tried to tell you here, but the same thing happens here. Now, that's, I think, was exactly your stuff, right? So this configuration, well, luckily, exactly this was considered in 2000. And again, my understanding is that it was what process like this, right? So in 1D, as long as there is no Cherenkov radiation, we said there is no recoil. So recoil and Cherenkov are basically the same thing.
You're saying 1D is so special, you cannot compare it.
Yeah.
1D is special, yes.
Yeah, 1D is extremely special because the hole is not, you're mixing up the hole with a simple hole in a 3D thing. The hole here is a fractional specific fractional charge object. Example, this charge is less than minus, this charge is like less than one for repulsive interactions.
Well, again, I don't need hopefully definition of charge, but at least on the kinematics level, it's it is pretty obvious. Now, the difference between particles and holes for some models become extremely special, and I hope to mention it in a few minutes. All right. So basically, this is yes. So to finish the idea of calculation. So I told what to do with Hamiltonian, and now what is about observable? So the spectral function. I talked about spectral vector is density density. So I have to come up with an operator for the density, and I need density at momentum of order of q. So for that, I'll write operator psi right dagger d. It will be creation of a density fluctuation with positive q. Psi right dagger d, taken at time zero, coordinate zero, and I have to convolve it with d dagger psi r at x t. So now the usual thing, Bazanite, so this is e to I phi r, this is e to minus I phi r, and then we have a very simple linear exponent with quadratic in phi Hamiltonian. So it's again the standard Gaussian integration. And I simplify things because I use the transformation that these entangles entanglement is a bad word, so I don't know. It separates the phi part and d part. So basically, after that, this average is separate average d dagger d times average e to I phi, e to minus I phi, with some additional linear in phi term, times Gaussian e to minus phi squared. So that results in the exponent mu s in terms of delta in the linear approximation. If I linearize in delta the answer, I'll get delta plus over pi. And I cannot go beyond linear because I did nasty things. Okay, I basically just cut off states without thinking what they do virtually, right? So I took initial band and just cut piece here, a piece here. And that allows me to look at exponent only in the linear order in the interaction. And that's why I have to expand mu s and delta plus to the first order, and delta plus in interactions also only to the first order. So that basically allows me quite easily to get to this result. But what about the spectral function? So that's all very simple for the structure factor, but what about spectral function? The difficulty is that as I'll just erase it, should that the exponent in the spectral function, let's call it mu a, Lattinger liquid, was proportional to k plus 1 over k. So it was 3 half minus 1 quarter k plus 1 over k. Okay, and that was exponent in the dependence of a of k epsilon proportional to 1 over epsilon minus vk to power mu a Lattinger liquid. So if I look at weak interactions, then k, which was what? Vf over v will be proportional to 1 plus some coefficient times v over v. And k plus 1 over k minus 2 is proportional to v over vf squared. Okay, so if I take out the constant, basically mu a starts with v squared. So it's not linear. And in principle, one can roll up the sleeves and do calculation of this type in higher order in the interaction, but it's tedious. So is there any other way? So here we got some deceptive intuition coming from Calogero-Sutherland model. So Calogero-Sutherland is a fantastic model where basically the wave functions and correlation functions are known due to Day 94. And then having this somewhat formidable formulas, you can just do the right Fourier transformation and find that the spectral function for this solvable model, integrable model, has a parallel singularity. Spectrum is not linear, okay? So A of k epsilon has singularity at some line, and you can look somewhere here. Prepare properly these formulas for Calogero-Sutherland and find expression of the type 1 over epsilon minus epsilon of k, where epsilon of k is this whole dispersion relation, which is different from the Fermion dispersion relation, it's true. But the exponent that you find is exactly Lattinger liquid exponent. So it's independent of k, and it fits exactly this expression, because k also can be calculated in Calogero-Sutherland model. So Calogero-Sutherland is a model with interaction of the type 1 over x squared with some constant lambda. You can express this k in terms of lambda. It's 1 over lambda, happens to be 1 over lambda. You can calculate this exponent and find that it just fits the Lattinger liquid. So later on, we realized that it's just sickness of the model.
I disagree completely.
Pardon?
I disagree completely.
Disagree with what? That it's sickness or it's...
No, it's sickness. The model is actually showing the basic physics of what's going on. It's only very, very close to KF. It modifies when there's a finite range to the... when one of our forces fall off. You get a small... You should go for one of a sine-squared model, which goes continuously. Yeah. You see that there's a small range near KF where the hole goes back to its kind of normal case, but it becomes a well-defined fractional statistics object away from KF. And the Calogero model is always a well-defined fractional statistics object. In the generate case, it kind of blurs as it approaches KF.
Right, but I didn't talk about statistics. I just tell that one can calculate...
Statistics and the exponents come out.
Pardon?
They're all related.
Fine, but...
The important thing is the fractional charge.
Okay, fine. I can... right, so basically you're... But we don't agree on that. So you're saying that in Calogero satellite model, exponent depends on statistics, and statistics is independent of wave vector. This is true. Just a second. And that means, that exactly means the same thing, that this exponent for Calogero is k-independent.
Yeah, in the modified model, it's k-dependent, and it eventually goes very close to KF.
If you take it to Sinch, right. But if you don't do Sinch, okay, you're getting just a constant. And
but the Calogero model is a good representation of the basic physics, just like the Lofgren state is a good representation of quantum Hall effect. It's modified by actual... Anyway, we can talk about that later.
We can talk about that.
I think I disagree with the point that the Calogero model is a completely kind of pathological model.
Oh, no, I didn't say that.
It teaches you the basic thing.
Right, I said sick. Okay, so I'm sorry. It's not sick. I take it back. It's not sick. But for a model with generic interaction, which perhaps are definitely less profound, but this doesn't hold.
No, I agree, but it's... Go on, anyway.
No, well, but I think it's important. The point of view is important. So, so basically, we understood the following. Yeah.
That's all right.
That's fine. So basically, this idea about bosonization. Allowed to make a leap, and actually it was done first in Pereira, Affleck, and White paper. And the leap was the following, that because we see that the singularities, Pavlov singularities, come from interaction of a quote-unquote deep hole with particles close to the Fermi level, let's replace the initial Hamiltonian with an effective one, where we just declare that states around the Fermi level are described by effective Luttinger liquid, and there is a hole interacting with Luttinger liquid, but we don't know, to start with, we don't know the coefficients, the constants in the model. So basically, the path to Fermiology starts here. We write the Hamiltonian for the low energy subspace in form of Luttinger liquid. K1 over K. We add a Hamiltonian of a particle that propagates with some energy epsilon d of k and linear spectrum and the interaction contains two constants. You write And you left. Times dagger d. So now, where to find? So this k and v, that simple is just Luttinger liquid, and can be related to thermodynamic quantities. Basically, if you know compressibility, you know these guys. What about epsilon d and URUL? So the idea of Affleck et al. Paper was that, okay, there are integral models, and they were looking at Heisenberg. We looked later on at Leibniger. So for an integrable model, you may calculate the finite size spectrum, 1/L corrections to the spectrum, from this Hamiltonian on one hand, but it's always possible, not only for integrable. But for integrable, you also know these corrections from the Bethe-Lanthas equations. So then you can match the finite size corrections done by phenomenology and by the Bethe-Lanthas. And this matching allows one to associate these parameters, epsilon d, ur, and ul, with some quantities in the Bethe-Lanthas. So that basically allows to evaluate the exponents if you know that some other solution of the Hamiltonian. Actually, it's pretty impressive because the, not specialist in it, but thermodynamic Bethe-Lanthas doesn't allow to find the dynamic quantities. And by this method, basically, you can read off the exponents in the dynamical correlation function from the finite size solution of the thermodynamic Bethe-Lanthas. But what we realized that actually having this philosophy about thermodynamic Hamiltonian, you can find a quite simple way to relate these constants UR and UL to observable quantities for a generic model without any knowledge of integrability. And in this sense, it's more general. It doesn't need specific assumption about interaction potential. And then actually we can check that for known models, including Kolodziejczyk, actually, this works. So that's another perhaps 5 minutes and we are done. So first of all, if we start with free fermions, okay, so we have the dispersion relation of free fermions, and as we discussed due to this question of Mischa Fuller, this whole part is kind of nice because holes don't relax. Now imagine that you turn on interaction gradually, okay? So you do something to this arc, but as long as you your interaction is not too strange, basically you keep still the velocity of a hole less than Fermi velocity. Basically, we assume that upon interaction, introducing the interaction, the spectrum of holes doesn't change qualitatively.
You said too strange or too strong?
Too strange. No, it can be strong, actually. Again, there are some specific examples where we know that this deformation actually changes this property. But it's really, it's like, well, for bosons near Fechtbach resonance, you may arrange the situation. But for a reasonable k dependence of interaction, it doesn't happen. Now, the part that corresponds to particles, these parts, actually are not good parts in the sense that particles can decay. So this part is not the real edge of the spectral function. So if I look at AFK epsilon, AFK epsilon is zero above this arc. It's not zero below the arc. Now, a similar consideration allows one to see a ghost bend. And it's similar to what we had for Luttinger liquid, where there were straight lines. And spectral function is not zero above the arc as well, but zero within this shape. And then, actually, if you go to k larger than kf, things repeat itself, and you may find non-zero value of a above some line But within a certain, well, repetition of this shape, A is zero again. So let's concentrate on this basic arc that corresponds to the original holes. So first of all, if I want the spectral function to be zero above this arc and non-zero below, I have to associate this shape with this quantity. So basically, by definition, epsilon d of k is the line at which A turns zero. Okay, so if one measures epsilon AFK epsilon, this the edge at which it turns zero, or above which is zero, it's epsilon d of k. But what about these quantities? So for these quantities, actually, one can do the same thing that was done for impurities of helium 3 and helium 4 in 50-something by Ebner and Bayham. So the idea is that if you give, if you have Galilean invariance of your system, you can write down the dispersion relation of a particle in two different frames, in reference frame, in left frame, and frame moving this together as liquid. So here is your liquid, okay? Here is a particle. And on one hand, we may pretend that one may measure the spectrum of particle in a moving liquid. U is the velocity of the liquid, as a function of V vector. Okay? On the other hand, we can relate this quantity to the spectrum in the lab reference frame. It's just Galilean transformation. So that reads in the following way. Epsilon D of Q plus M, this is a particle mass, so it's second derivative of this guy. Times velocity of liquid, VL, equals epsilon d of k plus k VL plus m VL squared over 2. Now, velocity of liquid, VL, can be related to gradient theta, because as you remember, gradient theta is density of momentum. So VL can be written as 1 over mass gradient theta. So, and now we have another consideration. I just look at the Hamiltonian and say, okay, I have average value of gradient theta. So this term is not zero, this term is not zero. And respectively, UR plus UL times gradient theta give an addition to the particle spectrum. So I can write in terms of the Hamiltonian constants of the Hamiltonian corrections to the particle spectrum. And then I relate the two. I relate the Galilean transformed epsilon d and epsilon d obtained from the Hamiltonian due to these terms. So that allows me to find the sum of the constants UL and UR. In terms of derivative. And another relation comes even simpler because I can do the same thing telling that, okay, now instead of boosting the system and giving some velocity to the liquid, I can just change its density and see what the density change makes to the spectrum. So again, empirically, epsilon d depends also on density, so it depends on density rho. And this way I can relate the change of the spectrum, the density, to the difference of the constants, because if I make phi not zero, I will relate u left minus u right to the corrections to spectrum. So in other words, algebra relation, 1/2, your left minus your right equals to d epsilon d over d rho plus pv over capital K. And this is v and k. So I would say beauty of the thing is that it puts the problem of this curved spectrum essentially on the same footing as Lagrangian liquid. It's a phenomenology. In Lagrangian liquid, you only need to know its compressibility and mass of a bare particle, and that defines K and V. Here, all you need to know is the energy corresponding to the edge, epsilon d of k, right? So calculation of, I mean, first of all, it's measurable. Second, calculation of energy is infinitely simpler than calculation of the dynamical property. Okay, it's just more or less conventional many-body physics. So if you know epsilon d of k and density, you know the parameters of your effective Hamiltonian. And the Hamiltonian is basically linear. So finding any dynamic quantity is just a routine here. So in particular, the spectral function A of K epsilon can be expressed in terms of the phase shifts. And the phase shifts are introduced the same way as I did in the toy problem in perturbation theory. But now there are two phase shifts due to the scattering of right and left movers. So there are two exponents. And the phase shift delta plus delta minus are related to the constants u right and u left. If I introduce this thing, I'll call u phi, and this u theta, then these phases are something very simple. It's 1 over dk epsilon k, epsilon of k, minus v, times square root k u phi, plus minus 1 over square root k u theta. So, and you can look at any dynamic correlator, the structure factor as well. So I just wanted to tell what kind of new things one can see.
The Leonid, before yes. You go on, just a quick
Sure.
Delta plus and delta minus, they are constants or they depend on k?
Yeah, you just take words from my mouth. So they do depend on k. So I'm talking about momentum, k, right? So
momentum k.
Right, yeah.
And
momentum
so u r and u l in each end also depend on
momentum, yes. And you see, momentum here is an external property to this Hamiltonian, because basically what it does, it replaces the initial band with a narrow band around the Fermi level, okay? And additional piece around momentum k. So momentum k is just a parameter that tells me where the particle is. So it's a parameter. So, and this parameter enters into the spectrum. And so this quantity, d epsilon, d rho, and d epsilon, dk, k proliferates into u phi, u theta, and proliferates into delta plus delta minus. Okay, so that gives k dependence. Now, so one thing is that generically there is k dependence. Now I can try to look at the limit momentum goes to kf. So, okay, it requires expansion of epsilon d in k. You do the expansion, you plug into this formula, plug into this, and you recover what? Not Lagrangian liquid. So recover exponents that is different from Lagrangian liquid exponents. And it's different because it's different regime. So basically that takes me back to this question about linearization and about the region of the width of order of k minus kf squared. So these exponents tell me what happens here. okay, near the mesh shell. Where reflecting the liquid, guess me what happens there. Now, once again, because of reasons that I don't understand, but maybe you'll explain me, for hole, there is no special region. So basically, the hole exponent stays the same. But for anything else, for anything that I know, there is a change. Now, another thing that is interesting for Calogero is that actually epsilon d, okay, it can be particle or hole. And for Calogero, there is a cusp at Fermi level.
There always is only holes. The hole is a solitonic excitation.
Well, the hole is a true excitation, I understand. And the particle, and above Fermi level, it's something. But once again, I can just take epsilon for a particle in Calogero and plug it into the formula just to see what happens. So you recover the right exponent, Latin derivative exponent, for particles as well. And here, technically, it comes from the fact that epsilon of k has a cusp between particles and holes. There is a difference in the velocities at in the negative mass, right, near the Fermi level.
Be related to the difference. If you take the case of Calogero, at the interesting coupling constants where it maps directly into fermionic or bosonic Laughlin, I mean, the whole thing is the same physics as the difference between the quasi-particle and
quasi-particle.
And these objects are fractional. The hole is the basic object, which is a fractional charge object. Now, in the Calogero model, the fractional charge of the hole doesn't depend on k. So it's like one, for example, it's the coupling constant of Calogero. Of course, the real hole, if you take non-interacting particles, the hole always has charge minus one in between kf and minus kf. Without the long-range forces in the Luttinger model, in the Calogero model, it'll always go to plus one or minus one at kf, but it renormalizes to its fractional value. And the Calogero fractional value is constant everywhere between kf and minus kf.
Right.
If you go to 1 over sine squared, which is like interpolates between Calogero and kind of delta function, there's a regime where it'll cross over, the charge of the hole crosses over from minus 1 up to an interesting non-trivial value.
So maybe I should say, I'm not sure. I would like to understand indeed whether it happens in the vicinity of KF or...
Yeah, exactly. In the vicinity.
Oh, it's vicinity. Okay, fine. Yeah, then...
KF, the whole charge...
Right, okay,
model with short-range forces will always end up...
Normalizes
to this other charge.
Right, I agree that if you regularize Calogero, then basically near KF, everything matches to the rules. Yeah, I agree.
In the general case, it will kind of scale to it'll be a k dependent charge, which is a difference of the right and left facies.
Yes, but again, perhaps I should stress another point that for a generic model, not Calogero, but some generic model with short range interaction, okay,
the Calogero 1 over sine squared immediately gives you short range interactions.
No, but I'm saying Calogero, nevertheless, okay, if you go away from KF, it gives some fixed exponent, and it's not true for for other soluble models, for sure. For example,
you're saying if you modify Calogero a little bit, 1 over sine squared,
yes,
you have a model which interpolates, and you can see exactly what's happening near KF.
That's perhaps true, but what I'm saying is that for other models which are soluble, and I don't know in which sense they correspond to fractional charge, nevertheless, you have exponents that is k-dependent, is momentum-dependent, and this momentum dependence is significant. It changes a lot. So since people are dead, I just want to mention two quick things where this thing goes. So one is that the same approach actually works for the Heisenberg model, because you can map Heisenberg onto fermions and use instead of Galerian invariance SU2 symmetry. And that immediately allows you to find exponents for the spin and excitations, which happen indeed k-independent, because the C2 symmetry just holds for any momentum. And that actually allowed to resolve some controversy between different values of exponents that were found by various people. Another host of problems are bosonic problems, and you can do it ad nauseum. For example, there is a question about ferromagnetic Bose gas, where the density excitations are like Schlesinger liquid, but the spin excitations are quadratic spectrum at small k, but you also can do the same tricks that were described here. And finally, I promised to mention the spin full case. So we are not entirely there yet, but actually this method allows to treat spinful fermions as well. So the general idea is that simply in the effective Hamiltonian, we have to introduce yet another branch, the spin excitations branch. And there are more constants, four instead of two. But for without magnetic field, SU2 symmetry and Galilean apparently allows us to, we have a conjecture, but it's not checked, it allows us to fix all the four constants and get the exponents for spinful case as well. I'll stop here. There are various more sophisticated things to tell about, but I think that I had enough of your attention. Thanks.
Just for the question, S was delta function, then it became like this.
Yeah.
And now, what is it now?
Okay, thanks, yeah. Lost. yeah. So it was a delta function, right? Then with finite mass, but no interaction, it became. Okay. Now, with repulsive interaction, it has a parallel divergence at the threshold frequency.
So
1 over omega minus omega minus.
Curve, so what happens
here? Yeah, just a second. So this is some... No, and then... I will not speak about it. There are some details here. We can discuss it. And then it just falls off and goes to arbitrary large omegas. So this S of omega given Q. And the decay is, if I remember right, it's 1 over omega squared at large omegas.
Singularity on the left side.
Singularity here. Okay, so now at omega plus, for integrable model, there is a non-analytical point. But if model is not integrable, then because of the lifetime of a particle, which is different from whole, it gets smeared and there is nothing special here. So basically, instead of delta function, there is also a parallel. So amazing things that like in Schlesinger liquid, delta functions gets replaced by parallels. But not only for the spectral function that used to be in Schlesinger liquid, but for density correlation function for structure factor as well. So instead of delta function, we are getting a parallel divergence at some lower edge.
How big
Okay, so exponent, you mean? So exponent depends on wave vector. For an interaction of order of one, it scales as Q over KF at small q. So the smaller the q, the smaller the exponent. And in a way, if you have curved spectrum from the point of view of density-density correlation function, it looks more like free fermions than Schlesinger liquid, because exponent goes to zero. It means that a box is a good approximation. The box corresponds to zero mu s. And the mu s goes to zero.
Okay, any other questions or comments?
So you considered first order perturbation, right? I mean, when you considered those bubble diagrams.
Right.
What the Fermi-Edge similarity. So, I mean, what about orthogonal catastrophe to?
Right, okay, thanks. So. So that's what I didn't want to do by bare hands, but the expression of the exponents through phases and phases through parameters of the spectrum has both. It has both orthogonality catastrophe and exciton. And if you want, you can expand. Again, I didn't finish it, but you can expand now in the interactions and get the terms that correspond to the perturbative expansion beyond the leading log.
For the derivation of this premise, when you said it was phenomenology, I wasn't clear on whether is it believed that this is sort of exact in some low energy limit or close enough to the singularity?
Yes. So the point, it is believed to be true when epsilon minus epsilon d of k goes to zero. Okay, so it.
And is there like do higher order terms fall off? Or is it an RG analysis that tells you that?
Okay, so the only thing that we were able to do is to look at residual terms. So you can try to find the correction to this power law. And to the best of our understanding, the corrections are less divergent powers. So I would say that it's like an RG argument, yes. Yeah. So in this, when you're close to zero in the denominator, higher order terms are small compared to this.
Any questions, comments?